The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello. Welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Elaine Shannon. She joins us on the telephone in Washington, D.C. Hello, Elaine.
Hi, how are you, Vic?
Excellent. Elaine, I just love this new book that you've put out. It's called Hunting LaRue, the inside story of the DEA takedown of a criminal genius and his empire. I had never heard of this guy.
Well, that's kind of the point. Everybody's heard about El Chapo, but El Chapo is 20, 30 years old. He was in my first book. Everybody's seen Miami Vice, which I absolutely adore, and Michael Mann is making a movie out of LaRue. He created Miami Vice, and that's just so much fun. But this is a different kind of trip into the real underworld. The real dark world, and it's not anything like I expected, and it sounds like you didn't expect it either.
How did you first hear about Paul LaRue?
Well, I was in the underground myself. I was poking around in what I call Middle Earth, which is this great swamp of money and drugs and arms. They're all mixed together now. And kidnapping and sales of ivory and animal parts and humans and human parts. Everything you can think of is being transacted. I was in Afghanistan specifically looking at how the heroin trade is paying for that war, all sides, killing our people, killing civilians, killing NATO allies. And I'm still working on that, on how to best tell that story. But one of the DEA agents who was out there told me about this strange man that he'd been with who had been arrested and had turned to work for Team America to take down the rest of his empire. He said he was brilliant. He said he was a computer genius. He said he was a guy who could pass for a businessman in Europe, unlike most of the traffickers that I'd run across. A guy who had taught himself, who had worked in possibly spy agencies, who had worked in corporations, and now was just making as much money as he could until he got arrested by DEA through a very ingenious plan. Well, naturally, I had to know all about that. So I dug in. I found out his name. Paul LaRue, nobody knew it. He was from a place that doesn't exist on the map anymore, Colonial Rhodesia. Mm-hmm. He grew up in South Africa, and then he floated around Europe doing what's called digital nomad work, IT work, helping law firms and banks and some government ministries secure their data back in the dawn of computer security. He was also here in the U.S. and Seattle, Virginia, maybe some other places. And then he decided he needed to be very, very, very rich. Not just rich, but very rich. And he was quite bent. He discovered that he enjoyed evil. So he moved to Manila. He started up an online pharmaceutical house doing the two things that Americans seem to love a lot, selling pills. Pills, we seem to love pills. We are a huge market for it, the biggest in the world. And we love online shopping. We love to do it at midnight when it's dark, the house is quiet, we'll run up our credit cards. He understood that, and he created some very enticing online pill shopping websites. He drew in about $300 million worth of sales in his first 4 years that they know of. Well, that's quite a bit for a startup. He decided to diversify into arms, weapon systems for Iran, meth made by North Korea, and murder.
He was very careful about the pills he sold. He's very careful about not being detected. He had all these different websites, And he really understood the internet. He used obsolete computer equipment. Because tell us the reasons why he did that.
Well, LaRue spent 10 years on learning cybersecurity, ground up, teaching himself. He was a guy that picked up things rapidly. And this was back when there was some security for your email, but you couldn't encrypt your entire computer. And you needed to encrypt your entire computer because in the early 90s, mid-90s, people were starting to get laptops, and business professionals were traveling with them. Military professionals, intelligence professionals were traveling with them. Well, when you leave a laptop in your hotel room in Hong Kong, the odds are very good that somebody's going to bribe the maid or just tell the maid to let that person in the room, and then they suck out everything on your laptop. Same thing happens if you're traveling to certain countries. If you were a student in the U.S. studying engineering and you went back to your home country, Iran, Saudi Arabia, someplace like that, the odds are excellent that you would be stopped at the border control and they'd take an external disk and suck out all the contents of your laptop, which for some people might just be pictures of the grandchild and the dog, but some would be a lot of business espionage that they'd get. So he was working on a system to do that, and he realized that he could use the same system to secure his servers. He could sell drugs. These are pills. He didn't sell many opioids at first. He avoided opioids because he knew that that was DEA territory, and DEA was a formidable threat to him. But he did sell a lot of other things, sleeping pills. And there were a lot of things back in the day that weren't illegal. We all know this sad story now. We all have friends and relatives who've gotten addicted to pills because the opioids that were made by Big Pharma were sold as not being terribly addictive, but they were. He was selling those, and as he got bolder, he got into more opioids. He realized, well, this is a cash cow, and then he got arrogant. They'll never catch me, and so he did get bigger, and he started at one point dealing with the Sinaloa cartel to smuggle some opioids in from Mexico. But by that time, he decided, I'm going to go just hardcore. They'll never catch me. So he started experimenting with growing coca and opium in Somalia. He built a big base in Somalia. He was going to build Amazon for drugs and arms in Somalia with a self-contained warehouse desalinization system, a fortress militia. He built a militia of about 300 people. He was going to bring in arms from everywhere, mainly the former Soviet Union, because they make excellent arms, and Iran, and he was going to sell small arms all over the world. He had barracks. He had a landing strip. He was building a landing strip, and he was building a port, so he was going to have everything he needed in Somalia, where nobody was looking for this kind of operation.
My guest is Elaine Shannon. Her book is Hunting LaRue, the inside story of the DEA takedown of a criminal genius and his empire. And as you read the book, the immense genius that she's describing, it's amazing. If this guy had used his intellect for something good, the good things that he could have done, but he went to the evil side. And this guy actually had telemarketing centers set up to call people up who had bought pills from his pill businesses to sell them more pills. The guy was brilliant.
He was, and he could also attack the servers of his rivals, because there are rivals in the pill business, and they're still out there. If you get on your phone today and you Googled some opioid like tramadol, you'll find an ad for it, or Vicodin, something like that, and it'll say maybe Canadian Pharmacy. There are other people out there, and they have a little chat line, a little box will pop up. Would you like to chat about what you'd like? Now, some of these may be legit, but some of them are not, and they say Canadian Pharmacy because that sounds harmless. It is not. If you order a very dangerous drug, and I have seen this done, Pretty soon a little message will pop up. You're in trouble. We're going to arrest you. You need to send us $4,000 right now in cryptocurrency. This, of course, is blackmail. And it scares people. And I may, maybe some people send them blackmail. This is an underworld that is huge. Paul LaRue was a pioneer of it. He understood the human mind. Unfortunately for him, there were two DEA agents, Tom Sendrick and Eric Stouch, who understood the human mind, too, and they learned his mind. They got inside his head, and that, to me, is the most amazing part of this story.
He actually had a network of doctors who would write him prescriptions for his pill mills, and it was the pill mills that really put him on the DEA's radar and brought in these two guys who you apparently had extensive contact with and were able to interview about the process of trapping LaRue. And it's just fascinating to read.
Right. Well, yes, he had the pill mills thing going. And unlike a lot of them, he wasn't shipping the pills from across the border. He was just corrupting certain pharmacies and certain physicians and people who weren't physicians to just write phony prescriptions, which would then be FedExed to whoever ordered the stuff. He had a huge FedEx account, and they used one account. So that's how there were some DEA agents in Minnesota that got on to that operation. But he was ingenious in avoiding the law, which was quite weak then. He gamed Google. Google was supposed to be looking for underground pill sources, and he created so many ruses that Google didn't figure out what he was doing. He gamed Visa and MasterCard, places like that, and he was starting to create his own Visa system. But the two agents that got him didn't know anything about the pill business. They heard about a different kind of person, a person who was in Somalia, who was trying to grow coca and opium in order to cut out the Colombian and Mexican traffickers, a person who was hiring a lot of mercenaries, a person who was killing people, a person who was dealing in gold, a person who was building a militia and bringing in arms and trying to take over the arms market in Somalia and throughout Africa, a disgruntled employee, a man that LaRue had employed and then tried to kill. This guy, we call him Jack, agreed to go back and work for LaRue, infiltrate his inner circle, and then help the two agents understand what was in LaRue's mind and then bring him to a place where he could be arrested. How they did that is just amazing because he had tons of money. He ate nothing but Domino's pizza and Big Macs. Those were his favorite foods. So he wasn't spending a lot of money. He just wanted to have the money. They figured out that he wanted something else, that he was just insatiably curious, and he wanted to know all the little tricks of the drug trade. And if they invented some tricks that he didn't know about, this fascinated him, and it was the bait that made him take the hook.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Since 1958, I've been joined by Elaine Shannon. It's the Book Nook, and we'll continue with Hunting LaRue right after this. Elaine Shannon joins me in the Book Nook today. Her new book is Hunting LaRue, the inside story of the DEA takedown of a criminal genius and his empire right before the break. You mentioned a guy named Jack, and if they had not gotten access to Jack, I'd say it's fairly likely that LaRue would still be out there doing what he was doing, don't you think?
Good chance. Of course, LaRue had a bad habit of threatening to kill people who worked for him. He got very paranoid, and he decided somebody would be stealing, and then he would sick his enforcement team on them. He even tried to kill or firebomb his own cousins in South Africa. He threatened to kill Jack. Jack was very loyal to him. Jack was an Olympic swimmer who became a Navy diver in Europe, worked in Operation Desert Storm, helping find mines that Saddam Hussein put under the sea, worked with the Navy SEALs, and kind of drifted to the Manila and was a dive bomb, was diving when he heard about a job with this rich, fat nerd, which he thought would be fun. It was at first buying luxury real estate. Who doesn't want to do that? Jack had run a construction company. LaRue needed a base built in Somalia. In fact, he needed two big bases built, very elaborate bases with fortifications, desalinization, power, internet, everything out in the middle of the desert. And he figured Jack could do that. So he sent Jack to Somalia to do that. They got pretty far along, but then he started accusing Jack of stealing from him. And then he sent his head enforcer, a guy named Joseph Hunter, to go get Jack. Well, Hunter's a stone killer. Mm-hmm. He's now in jail for murder. He was a sniper trainer in the U.S. Army. Everybody who's ever met him says he's an absolutely terrifying-looking guy, all muscle, always ready to spring. And he did not go along with the pact that the people who worked for LaRue had made, which was, if he tells you to kill me, then we get some fake blood, we take some photographs, we make me look dead, then I disappear. Mm. Hunter was really going to kill Jack. So Jack figured this out, took off, and while he was taking off, he dropped a tip into the CIA tip line. There's one on the web, giving his real name, his real number. CIA didn't do anything with that information, but did retain it. So about a year later, when Tom and Eric, the two DEA agents, were trying to figure out how to penetrate LaRue's circle, one of their colleagues ran the name against the CIA database, and up came Jack's name and number. The two agents called Jack, not expecting much, because, gee, you know, who answers a cold call like that? But Jack was ready to go to work for DEA because he had decided he would never have a day's rest. His girlfriend would never have a night's sleep as long as LaRue was out there, because he was terribly vengeful. So Jack came to work for DEA, and he went back into the organization and got very, very, very close to LaRue. In fact, the image on the cover of my book, Hunting LaRue, is taken from a body recorder that Jack was wearing, and it is very up close and personal.
Yeah, when he's trying to set LaRue up, they had to lure him to a country where they could capture him, and it wasn't looking like it was going to work. It really took a lot of determination and planning to somehow lure him out, and the thing that really worked for him was LaRue wanted to have contacts with cocaine cartels from Colombia. He saw this as a real business opportunity. He wanted to be able to bring cocaine into Asia, and he had access to all this North Korean meth. I think I just saw something in the New York Times the other day about the North Korean meth. I had not known that this was a big export product from North Korea and that they subsidized their nuclear weapons with meth sales. This is just bizarre.
That's right. But hey, it works. Drugs have a greater profit margin than almost anything, that I can think of, because you can get a barrel of chemicals, and if you know how to do it — I do not, but if you do know how to do it, you can make some very high-grade stuff. If you're not bothered, if you try to make it in your kitchen, mom-and-pop lab, it's not going to be great stuff, and it's not going to sell for that much. But in the case of North Korea, it was clearly made in industrial conditions in a place with a lot of air controls and water controls, because the DEA lab tested the North Korean meth that the DEA agents got from LaRue and from some other places. They got some seizures in South Korea of meth on its way out to market. This stuff was all 99.7% pure, which is extraordinary. The way they know that it's all comes from North Korea is it had a certain impurity in it, an organic substance. I don't know what it was, but it's just a little bit of trash that wasn't supposed to be there. And that turned out to be a signature that goes to a certain industrial scope lab in North Korea. No one believes that this lab could make tons, and that's what it was offering, tons, a month. Nobody believes that that could happen without the active consent of the regime. The North Korean regime gets kickbacks. Maybe it's the kickbacks are used to buy brandy and Mercedes-Benz and things like that, but everybody believes, and undercover agents have been told, that part of the money goes to help the weapons program.
Mm.
And, of course, the weapons program aims to create long-range missiles that can carry a nuclear warhead and that can reach the continental United States.
It's ironic, as they are trapping LaRue, as they are setting this plan into motion, it seems ironic that here's a guy who has said he doesn't trust anybody, and he sort of starts trusting Jack, who he once wanted to kill. And it was weird for me to read this because as they're getting ready to trap LaRue, I almost started rooting for him. I don't know what it was in my mind, but I started almost feeling sorry for him.
Okay. Well, he has that effect, doesn't he?
Uh-huh.
That is part of his manipulation. That's one of the problems with trying to do a biography. Why did he turn so evil? And let me talk about evil. When the DEA agents lured him to Monrovia, Liberia, they did that because they knew that it was a sketchy enough place that he'd go there. It's a good place because it has transportation, it has communications, it has hotels, but it had a long civil war, so it was pretty torn up. LaRue assumed that he could corrupt everybody he wanted to. He could buy who he wanted, and that he could use it for his fleet of yachts. He could use it for smuggling. And theoretically, he could have, but except that Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was the president, and she didn't want any drug traffickers there. She was struggling to bring peace to her country, and she'd just gotten a Nobel Prize for doing so. She wasn't having any of this bribery. She put her stepson in charge of the security police. He's close with DEA, and he agreed to arrest LaRue. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf signed the expulsion order, which would send LaRue to New York to face a judge and jury there. This is very important because if he's expelled, that can happen secretly.
Mm.
It's all legal. It's with a warrant. It's with an indictment, but there's not a long extradition process, which means his men, his enforcers, his hitmen did not know. LaRue, he immediately flipped when he got on the DEA plane, and one of the things he said, he was describing all his assets, his safe houses, his yachts, his planes, his boats, and he said, I had an island, but it got overrun by guerrillas. That was a problem for me. And the agent said, well, why did you want an island? And he said, every villain needs an island.
Yeah. And then he flips, and he actually seemed to enjoy entrapping his own people and destroying his own empire and playing these games with the DEA where they would spend all this time sending communications to people who didn't realize that he had been captured.
That's right. Very few of his employees knew what he looked like. Very few of them had ever met him. He stayed alone in his various safe houses, which include, interestingly, one of them was a penthouse looking at downtown Manila. It was in a tower. He had both penthouses and both towers in this luxury building in Manila. One was totally empty, and it was used in case the cops bust in, they'd find nothing. He was in the other tower with a chair, a table, a little sofa, a widescreen TV, and a big pile of guns. That was it. And two cooks, except the cooks didn't do anything because his favorite food was Big Macs and Domino's Pizza, which you can get in Manila. And that's why he's 350 pounds. He just didn't come out much, and he had a lot of women. He brought in prostitutes. He had many girlfriends. He boasted that he had 11 children by seven women that he knows of, and there are probably a lot more. He liked to pay for sex. He liked anonymous sex. He liked twosomes, threesomes, foursomes. But his employees never knew where he was. So he could, when he flipped, he could sit there in the U.S. courthouse being minded by DEA agents on either side, and he could tap out orders to his henchmen here and there. And they had no idea that he was doing it basically from the slammer.
Amazing. The book is Hunting LaRue, the inside story of the DEA takedown of a criminal genius and his empire. Elaine Shannon wrote it, and she joins us in the Book Nook today. Near the end of the book, we have a situation where they have caught these two guys who were hired killers for LaRue, but they were kind of subcontractors. And it was really scary when they went to get these guys. The one guy in his trailer, how many guns did he have?
Oh, that was in Roxboro, North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
A tiny town, about 6,000. He probably had, at least 60. I just tweeted a picture of some of them. He had long guns. He had handguns. This is a guy, Carl David Stilwell, he made holsters. He made brassieres that you could put guns in. In fact, with the money that he got for killing this woman in the Philippines, he put a picture of himself on a new Harley. Well, actually, it was a used Harley, a police Harley that he bought on the used Harley market. And he said, "This is my new Harley, blood money. I'm going to use my money to get her painted."
Yeah. These guys were idiots. They were supposed to kill this woman who was a real estate agent. And they did, in fact.
LaRue wanted this 30-year-old Filipino woman killed. She had bought luxury real estate for LaRue. Her name was Catherine Lee, and he took it into his head, and I say that advisedly, that she stole from him. Maybe she did, maybe 1,000, maybe 2,000. Maybe she just added more of a commission on than he thought was fair, and he was a cheap guy. So he nagged and nagged Joe Hunter, his head enforcer, who was this drill sergeant, sniper trainer. He said, I want her killed. And you know how it is when you have a boss and he nags you and nags you. So Hunter was going nuts. Who could he get to do the killing? There had been some professional killers that had killed a woman that was kind of like this a few months earlier, but they didn't want to do another job. And so Hunter was casting around for what idiot could he do to do the killing himself. He didn't want to do it himself. He wanted to hire it out to some fool who would do the job. So he got two fools. He got them out of North Carolina, Adam Samia and Carl David Stilwell. They just were tracked down by the DEA agents. They were put on trial in New York last year, and they were both sentenced to life plus 20.
Mm.
They had one of them, Stilwell, lived in a double-wide trailer, and there were so many guns, the agent's feet were crunching on guns as they went through to take the guns out. The other guy had fewer guns, but he had Adam Samia. He was the trigger man. He had a 50-caliber machine gun mounted on a tripod on his pool table.
Yeah.
Now, that's a gun that can shoot effective fire from Capitol Hill to the White House. Those cartridges are bigger than my hand.
Huh.
So he didn't need that in Roxboro or horse farm. He did it. He just liked guns, and he advertised on LinkedIn as a security specialist, and the DEA agents went after him, even though the murder was in the Philippines and theoretically the jurisdiction of the Philippines, because they weren't going to try these murderers. And the DEA guys said, "We cannot have two men who enjoy killing sitting in 30 or 40 miles from Raleigh, North Carolina, and ready to go anytime to kill anywhere."
And these fools actually held on to the car keys to the vehicle they murdered the woman in as a souvenir. Just really disgusting.
That's correct. It was found in the house in Roxboro near the 50-caliber machine gun. They also retained photographs of her. They shot her one shot under each eye. That was clearly a message to other people in LaRue's organization because it was just grotesque. Mm. They had the photographs. They let her bleed out in the van that belonged to LaRue. There's a lot of blood in the human body, and LaRue himself got out there with a hose at one point and tried to get it out of that van. Couldn't do it entirely, and that van is now in custody and was part of the evidence in the case, the prosecution, which was in New York.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Elaine Shannon. We're talking about her book, Hunting LaRue, and we'll continue our conversation right after this. It's the Book Nook on WYSO, and it's my pleasure to have Elaine Shannon on the program. Her book is Hunting LaRue, the inside story of the DEA takedown of a criminal genius and his empire. And just last week, I had Don Winslow back on the program for his wonderful new novel, The Border. And I found out about your book because Don tweets about it all day long. He loves your book. And I thought, well, if Don loves it, I'm going to have to read it, and I have to agree with him. I love the book. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Elaine. Tell us how you got into this field and what you've been doing.
Well, first of all, let me say that Don Winslow is a marvelous writer, and I'm very happy to hear that. Of course, I'm a journalist. He's an artist. I just write facts, and I don't have the color and the artistry, but sometimes you don't need them.
Mm-hmm.
I have been a journalist all my life. I started out at the Nashville Tennessee, and then I worked at Newsweek. I worked at Time Magazine for 20 years, and I've always covered the dark side. Why? I don't know. My boss, when I went to Newsweek, said, well, you look like the kind of person who can handle hard targets, and that's what we need to do. Turned out I was quite good at it. I'm very straightforward, and I find that people in law enforcement are very straightforward and direct, don't like to dissemble, don't like to lie. I don't either, and we get along. Mm. My first book was Desperados, about the Latin drug trade, and it was specifically about the murder in Mexico of DEA agent Kiki Camarena, who was killed not only by traffickers but also by people in the government allied with the traffickers. This was an ugly story that a lot of people in our government did not want out because it messed up trade with Mexico. Mexico's our number one or number two trading partner, and there were all kinds of financial implications when the U.S. government, meaning Customs Service and DEA, cracked down on the border trying to find the body of the agent, or him if he was alive. My stories caused an uproar, but it uncovered a lot of corruption in Mexico. Things changed. The government couldn't lie about corruption in Mexico anymore. I think now all of your listeners know how bad corruption is in Mexico, and it's gotten worse.
Mm.
I continued to write about corruption, drug trafficking, espionage, all sorts of things all over the world. And when I left Time a few years back, I decided, well, I'm going to go to Afghanistan and find out what's going on with the heroin trade there and how much more about it our government knows than is telling. Quite a bit. It wasn't as bad as Mexico because the corruption was so obvious and blatant and happy that there wasn't much of a cover-up there. But I tell you what, there are kingpins there that are very, very ingrained in their society, and that's one of the reasons this war goes on and on and on, because it is a self-funding war. And then, as I said, I was looking to broaden out my book project into all the places that drugs pay for war, pay for terrorism, and there are a bunch of them. I happened on to the LaRue story right as it was unfolding, and I said, well, I need to do that. I told Michael Mann, the brilliant filmmaker, about the story as I was working on it, and he said, well, I want to do that. And I said, well, if you want to do that, I want to do that. We're in. We're together. So we've been working together. He would read chapters, and he would point out things that might restructure, things like that. He would never, never, never ask me to change anything or fictionalize anything, but he's coming from the world of documentarians. He's got a great eye for what will make sense, and is this too complicated? Does it need to be stretched out a little bit, explained more? Is this boring? Do you need less? That sort of thing. So he ended up with this terrific book that is coming out under the Michael Mann imprint at HarperCollins. He's created a book division of himself, and Don Winslow, I think, and others may be in the future published by him, by the Michael Mann imprint, but right now this is the first book under it. And it's going to be a feature film probably next year.
Are you saying that Michael was filming you as you were doing interviews? Did I get that right?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
No, I would just periodically talk to him, and he would say things like, well, can you find out more about what's going on in his head?
Oh.
His childhood. And I'd say, well, that's tough, because he's from a place that doesn't exist anymore. But I would try, and then I would find people who knew him. And he had dropped hints. For instance, I talked to his first boss, who turned out to be fascinating, a guy who's an Italian-German who created a cybersecurity company because he'd been a teenage hacker, and he knew how to hack into things, and he knew how to protect companies from being hacked. He was selling that service, and he hooked up with LaRue because he saw that LaRue was very talented at some complicated coding. Turned out LaRue betrayed him, stole from him, lied to him. And the thing about LaRue is that a lot of things he says, he might say he was sad about his father just as a manipulation to make you feel sorry for him so that you do something for him, like help him with some code. It's hard to say exactly what is true about him, but here's one thing that I know is true, and so does his first boss and so does everybody else. He likes power. He likes to use his mind to outwit people. He was not expecting two ordinary agents to outwit him. He didn't think anybody could outwit him. He thought he was brilliant.
And if they hadn't caught him when they caught him, they probably never would have caught him. Near the end of the book, you write, being simultaneously indifferent and insatiable is what narcissists do. It's the reason narcissists make excellent innovators. They don't stop, and they don't yield to logic or compassion. That really stuck with me.
Yes. Well, there are some studies that show that argue that there are four times as many psychopaths in the upper echelons of corporate America as there are in the general population. These are studies. I don't know whether that number is true, but we've all met people who are ruthless, who are happy, who are greedy, and who are not ashamed. Psychopaths don't commit suicide because they don't feel bad.
Mm.
If something goes wrong, they just blame other people, and they dump those people, whoever it is, kids, wife, husband, friends, and they move on. And I think he's that type. So when Michael Mann, who started out as a documentarian looking at abnormal psychology, he and I share a common interest in trying to get inside the head of people who look like us, sound like us, seem perfectly reasonable, and LaRue usually did. He had lost his temper occasionally, but usually people who are around him say, well, you know, he seemed very even-keeled and calm. Yeah. But there's something else going on in his head that's very scary.
Mm.
And we're both interested in this phenomenon.
And I suppose if you have any regrets, the main one would be you couldn't get an interview with him. Whoa.
Someday I will.
That must have been a really tantalizing prospect to think maybe. Did you have any chance at all of getting an interview with him?
I could not at the time I was doing the book, and I can't today because he has not been sentenced.
Oh.
The reason he hasn't been sentenced is because there are still outstanding appeals in the case of the three hitmen against whom he testified. Joe Hunter, Adam Samia, and
Stilwell.
Yeah. Those three are still pending appeals in New York. He also has been trying to change lawyers and various things, so at some point he'll get sentenced, and then he'll become part of the general prison population, and I'll know when that happens, and I will write him and see if he'll see me. I don't know whether he will, because he'll have to figure out what's in it for him. I can't give him anything, and I wouldn't give him anything. I don't buy interviews with money or with favors or with favorable treatment. I can't do that. I wouldn't do that. So we'll see. And then, of course, we know that he's a liar, a manipulator. It still would be fun to see him.
Uh-huh.
I've had a good time interviewing agents who sat with him when he communicated with members of his gang, when he was trying to draw them all in to be arrested. Which, by the way, he was very happy when that happened. He heard about it, and he asked the agents, "Is this good for me?" And they said, "Yeah, it's good for you."
Uh-huh.
And he was happy to have betrayed everybody he ever met.
I'm waiting for the paperback to come out, and I want to see Paul's blurb.
He might like it.
That's what I'm saying. He might write you a blurb for the paperback.
Well, we'll see if he will, because he's got a giant ego.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's, to me, the most interesting. Tom Sendrick and Eric Stouch are ingenious detectives. They are old-school shoe-leather detectives. They have rolled around in a lot of alleys in bad parts of Washington and bad parts of Baltimore with people who probably had minimal educations and no family lives, but they were pretty good at selling drugs. And so these guys are both very smart. If you look at them, they're not, well, they try to dress down. They try to look ordinary. That's a cop thing. Don't let it fool you. They have very, very keen minds. Their boss, Lou Million, is one of the keenest minds I've ever met. He has run a number of very successful international stings against some of the most brilliant and successful untouchable criminals in the world. Victor Boot, who is the biggest criminal small arms dealer in the world, and was supplying the African guerrillas who were training boy soldiers and girl soldiers and keeping sex slaves and doing a horrible thing. And Manzor El Kassar, who was the financier of the Achille Lauro kidnapping and the Palestinians back in the day. They outwitted both of these people, who were very, very insulated.
Elaine Shannon joins us on the program. We've been talking about her book, Hunting LaRue, The Inside Story of the DEA Takedown of a Criminal Genius and His Empire. And I think the scariest thing in the book, and there's a lot of scary things, but to me as a reader, was that Paul LaRue was working to help the Iranians design guidance systems for missiles. This is unreal.
That's right, and it's happening. And when the Iranians finally master this technology, it's going to be a game changer. To back up a little bit, the U.S., back in the 80s, maybe even before, the United States and the other industrialized nations agreed that they were not going to sell rogue nations and the Soviet Union and some other countries guidance technology that would enable missiles to hit targets more accurately. So GPS systems that you buy commercially, you go into a sports store and you buy a GPS system for your boat so you can go fishing, or one for your Cessna, your plane, whatever. These things cannot operate at certain altitudes and certain velocities. And the reason is that the GPS chip in the system is hobbled, it's crippled, so that it can't operate in a missile.
Mm.
Paul LaRue told the Iranians that if they would sell him a lot of small arms for his inventory for his arms depot. And he would reprogram the chip in commercial GPS systems, and we're talking $30 chips, so that the missile technology safeguards could be overcome, and that chip would drive a rocket, a small rocket or a missile. The beauty of this would be that Iran could use these fixed chips to put into small rockets and missiles that a couple of guys could carry around. These could be given to Hezbollah and Hamas, which are regularly rocketing Israel. Right now, the Israeli Defense Force estimates that Hezbollah has about 150,000 small rockets and missiles that came from Iran and that can be used to pound Israel. Most of the time, they just hit sand whenever their volleys are fired off. But if they were smart, if they were what they call precision-guided missiles, then that would change. That would be a game changer. They could hit the water system, the command and control towers, the defense ministry, all kinds of defense system, and they would overwhelm the Iron Dome missile defense system that Israel has right now. The Iron Dome works because not many missiles go anywhere close to population centers, but if you start firing smart projectiles at population centers, then the Israeli system can't take care of all of them, and therefore will have to triage into protecting the most strategic systems, which means countless civilians will die because they will be less priority than the defense systems. This is terribly urgent. Israeli press, which I read, says that Iran has an accuracy project, and it's trying to get more accurate missiles from many, many comers, not just LaRue. But LaRue had a team of about 30 engineers from Romania mostly in a bunker near Manila working on improving Iran's missile navigation. He thought that if this project worked, then Iran would pay him $100 million. He had an FTP server set up to exchange data with the Iranian scientists and engineers, and that's kind of like a cloud sharing server, except it's not a public cloud. They had their own cloud. I cannot tell you what a benefit LaRue was able to give Iran. I don't think we'll ever know unless we get some Iranian engineer who can tell them this or that. But if you read the Iranian press, every day they're advertising that their missiles are getting better. And in fact, one senior Iranian official recently boasted that Iran could now target and hit all of the American installations in the region. I don't know whether that's true, but I would hate to see this kind of shooting erupt, because then there will be a wider war. A lot of people will die, and the U.S. and the NATO allies could get drawn into a hot war. We don't want to see that happen.
Paul LaRue is like a villain from a James Bond novel. Elaine, we really appreciate your time today.
Well, it was so nice of you to have me in. I hope you all stay safe out there in Ohio.
Thank you for that. The book is Hunting LaRue, the inside story of the DEA takedown of a criminal genius and his empire. Elaine Shannon wrote it, and she's been my guest today on the Book Nook. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening.